Well, hello and welcome to Leaving the Village. I am your host, Jessica Goforth.
And I am your host, Kathleen Reynolds.
And we're back with Handmaid's Tale this time. Our Handmaid's Tale book club is resuming after many months.
Woo!
Yeah. We've taken some time off. If you listen to our other episodes, you know that what's up with us and been happening lately, but we're back from the holidays and yeah, we've been reading.
Yep. And we're getting there. We're right now we're doing chapters 27 through 29 and
yep.
That puts us close to 3/4 of the way through. So
yeah, when we're done, we'll be 3/4 of the way through. I actually really like this section. This is fascinating.
Yeah, it really kind of intensifies the stories and the character development. It really kind of amps things up a little bit.
Yeah, you finally get a bit of a more background of what was going on. How all this happened, how we got to where they are now, because Margaret Atwood kind of dumps us in head first at the beginning, and now we're kind of getting more background.
Yep.
So this next chapter, 27, kind of dives in, like you were saying, on character development, just some more of June and her relationship with Offglen, and then the next chapter kind of moves into more of like what was happening in the fall of Boston and the beginning of Gilead.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next chapter moves into the whole relationship with the commander.
Mm-hmm.
And gives more context there.
So now we have, starting with chapter 27, mm-hmm. I walk with Offglen along the summer street. It's warm, humid. This would have been sundress and sandals weather once. And then in the next paragraph, she says, Offglen and I walk slowly today. We are hot in our long dresses, wet under the arms, tired. At least in this heat, we don't wear gloves. And it just kind of struck me, the juxtaposition of, you know, it used to be sundress mm-hmm. and sandals weather. And now she mentioned earlier in the book how they did have heavier dresses for the winter and lighter dresses for the summer, but if you've worn a long sleeve cotton dress or linen dress, it's still hot when it gets hot and humid because it still hangs on you. Those of you who are from humid climates, you know that once the humidity is out, it doesn't matter what's on you, it hangs. And there's no drying off once you're wet. But that's why a sundress or a tank top and shorts, something like that, is great because you don't have all of this stuff hanging all over you.
And just sticking to you.
Like, yes, ugh. Exactly. Exactly. And long skirts are the worst in humid weather because they stick to your legs.
Ugh.
And they actually can be a hazard. Any of us who have worn long ankle-length skirts in hot, humid weather have been nearly tripped by them mm-hmm. more than once.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... try to do that and not break your neck.
Yep. I think this section here where they... you know, they're just walking together for a while and, you know, June kind of waxes eloquent about, or Offred, about the different buildings that they pass and trying to remember mm-hmm. what used to be in them, and then talking about how the food, how they get their food when they go shopping and what's mm-hmm. available and what's not available anymore. But they pass this one building that's called
I think it's just known as Soul Scrolls.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it is. Okay, it's known as Soul Scrolls. And they, you know, they're told that there's one of these in every city or every suburb, and that you call in, or the wives usually of the commanders do, and they order a certain prayer, and then the prayer is, there's different types of prayers. There's like prayers for health and wealth and a death or a birth or a sin. And you pick one, the one you want, you punch in the number, and then you punch in your own number so your account will be debited. So I guess they pay for these. And then you punch in the number of times you want the prayer repeated. And then these machines, it says, the machines talk as they print out the prayers, if you like. You can go inside and listen to them. The toneless metallic voices repeating the same thing over and over. Once the prayers have been printed out and said, the paper rolls back through another slot and is recycled into fresh paper again. There are no people inside the building. The machines run by themselves. You can't hear the voices from outside, only a murmur, a hum, like a devout crowd on its knees. Each machine has an eye printed in gold on the side, flanked by two small golden wings. And it's so interesting. So they're standing outside of this place. And she said, "Off Glenn and I stand outside Soul Scrolls, looking through the shatterproof windows, watching the prayers well out from the machines and disappear again through the slot, back into the realm of the unsaid. Now I shift my gaze. What I see is not the machines, but Off Glenn, reflected in the glass of the window. She's looking straight at me. We can see each other's eyes. This is the first time I've ever seen Off Glenn's eyes, directly, steadily, not aslant. Her face is oval, pink, plump but not fat, her eyes roundish. She holds my stare in the glass, level, unwavering. Now it's hard to look away. There's a shock in this seeing. It's like seeing somebody naked for the first time. There's risk suddenly in the air between us. There was none before. Even this meeting of eyes holds danger, though there's nobody near. At last, Offglen speaks. Do you think God listens, she says, to these machines? She is whispering, our habit at the center. In the past, this would have been a trivial enough remark, a kind of scholarly speculation. Right now, it's treason. I want to stop for a second because, like, there's a lot there.
Yeah.
I just, like, they don't even really get a chance to look at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time they're just looking in each other's eyes.
Well, because they're not supposed to be companions. They're not supposed to be friends. They're supposed to be accountability. They're supposed to be spies on each other.
Right.
And that's why even this meeting of eyes holds danger, because Offglen could be testing her.
Right.
It could be, you know, if you betray the wrong thing,
right,
in looking back, then you're SOL. Right. And try to keep it clean here. Yeah. And then for Offglen to ask this kind of question,
yeah,
is gutsy.
It's really a moment that Offglen's decided to be really brave. And so it continues. She says, I could scream. I could run away. I could turn from her silently to show her I won't tolerate this kind of talk in my presence. Subversion, sedition, blasphemy, heresy, all rolled into one. I steel myself. No, I say. She lets out her breath in a long sigh of relief. We have crossed the invisible line together. Neither do I, she says. Though I suppose it's faith of a kind, I say. Like Tibetan prayer wheels. What are those, she asks. I only read about them, I say. They are moved around by the wind. They're all gone now. Like everything, she says. Only now do we stop looking at one another. Is it safe here? I whisper. I figure it's the safest place, she says. We look like we're praying is all. What about them? Them, she says, still whispering. You're always safest out of doors, no mic. And why would they put one here? They'd think nobody would dare. But we've stayed long enough. There's no sense in being late, getting back. We turn away together. Keep your head down as we walk, she says, and lean just a little towards me. That way I can hear you better. Don't talk when there's anyone coming. We walk, heads bent as usual. I'm so excited I can hardly breathe, but I keep a steady pace. Now more than ever, I must avoid drawing attention to myself. I thought you were a true believer, Ofglen says. I thought you were, I say. You were always so stinking pious. So were you, I reply. I want to laugh, shout, hug her. You can join us, she says.
And that right there is where the bomb gets dropped.
That you is the moment.
Can join us.
Mm-hmm. And this is what Alfred's been circling around this whole time, is this feeling of like, there's got to be more people like Moira that are willing to just fight back, take off, run away.
She was saying that there's always a resistance.
Right.
We talked about that in an earlier episode, how there's always some sort of a resistance, and there's always some sort of an allyship. There's always something, some kind of underground, something going on in any kind of totalitarian in any kind of totalitarian regime, there's always something. She knew there had to be something.
Mm-hmm.
And this is her first actual confirmation that, yes, actually, there is.
There is. And you can join us. Ah, it's this huge moment. And so she says, us? There's an us? There's a we? I knew it. You didn't think I was the only one, she says. I didn't think that. It occurred to me that she may be a spy, a plant, set to trap me, such as the soil in which we grow. But I can't believe it. Hope is rising in me, like sap in a tree, blood in a wound. We have made an opening. I want to ask her if she's seen Moira, if anyone can find out what's happened to Luke, to my child, my mother even. But there's no time. Too soon we're approaching the corner of the main street, the one before the first barrier. There will be too many people. Don't say a word, Ofglen warns me, though she doesn't need to in any way. Of course I won't, I say. Who would I tell? Who could I tell?
There was something earlier too, where when they were done shopping, right as they're getting ready to walk home, and talking about where they're getting more comfortable with each other, she says, Ofglen and I are more comfortable with one another now. We're used to each other. We don't bother much with the formalities anymore when we greet each other. We smile and move off in tandem, traveling smoothly along our daily track. Now and again, we vary the route, but there's nothing against it, as long as we stay within the barriers.
Oh, yeah.
A rat in a maze is free to go anywhere, mm-hmm. as long as it stays inside the maze.
Yes. That struck me, I remember so well. One of the big things about life at the training center in Indianapolis was walking the parking lot.
Laps. That's exactly what I thought of.
Yes. Us laps girls.
And laps and laps in and laps. Twos or threes or fours or sixes.
Mm-hmm. But usually two or three.
And over again. Mm-hmm.
And almost all of us were girls.
Yeah. And sometimes we do miles. Mm-hmm. Just around and around and around and around. And sometimes we'd vary it a little bit. We'd go the other direction, or we'd cut across the middle, or zigzag through the rows. But usually it was just
round
and
round.
Usually it was just all the way around the perimeter. Yep. And like, you can
rain or
tell
shine,
how long.
Day in, day out.
Snow, ice. I did it mm-hmm. on crutches in the ice and snow.
Yeah. Like, we were desperate to get outside. It was what we, it was.
That tells you how, yeah. It now, granted, I'm very adept on crutches and I'm very adept in the ice and snow because that's where I'm from. Now, my husband would laugh at me if he heard me say I'm adept in the ice and snow because I shattered my radius falling on the ice, but
that's not good.
You know, you walk on ice enough.
Something happens.
Especially when they don't have any place for you to walk other than ice, but.
Yeah, anyway. But no, like, that was immediately what came to mind. Yep. I just pictured us in all of our matching outfits, you know, walking the perimeter of the parking lot.
Your long
lot.
Skirts, which.
Yep.
It really didn't matter how, like. Your shoes would always be wet and cold, and the hems of your skirts, even if they weren't super duper long, mm-hmm. if they were long enough, by the time you were done, if it was wet or cold or snowy or whatever, they would be wet by the mm-hmm. time you were done. And it was just, but that was what we did. We had nowhere else to walk. We had nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
That was our maze, and we were free to walk anywhere in that parking lot we wanted.
I remember looking over and thinking, there's a sidewalk, you know, because the building was a large part of one city block. You know, there was a road on either side, or on three sides, and on the back side was another building. I think it was a museum or something.
It was a children's museum.
Yeah, it was a children's museum. But I remember thinking, if we could just walk the block, like we could walk around
we
the block,
walked,
like that would be cool.
And you know what? Like people could look out from almost any angle of the training center and seen us walking on any point of that block, almost probably mm-hmm. 95% of that block. Mm-hmm. At any time of year. During the winter, probably 100% of the block. And yet, nope, we have to stay on the property. You cannot walk around the block. You have to stay on the property.
Yep. We did.
And
we did. You know,
it's not even about... It was all about power and control, too. Because it's not about... Oh, well, there are minors. You have to... Because a lot of us were 18 or older.
Oh, vast majority.
I get it. Parts of that area were kind of sketchy. But not for five or six 18-year-old plus.
Together in a group in the middle of the day? No.
No.
No. And, you know, when I first got there... In 96, they had, you know, some people would get together groups and walk to Wendy's and get a Frosty. And
yeah, which
I remember
was kind of across the street.
It was. It wasn't far. Mm-hmm. Maybe two blocks. And I remember desperately trying to get in with a group that would be allowed to go, the type of people that would be allowed to go. And I think I got permission to go one time because I just happened to be chumming around with the right people that day who got permission for that type of thing. And we walked over to Wendy's and it just felt so crazy, like to be out of the barricades, you know?
Yeah, when I was there for that long period of time when I wound up having my horror story, this was before I had that happen. I at one point wound up getting permission to walk, I think it was three blocks south, on the same side of the street down to Subway with one mm-hmm. of my friends, and we were both over 18. I think she was 18 and I was 21, and mm-hmm. that was close enough that we just had to like talk to Mr. Gurney, and we had to actually meet with him and
that's so funny.
Get permission for that. But then there was another one that was a little bit of a bigger deal because this was a different friend of mine and I who we wanted to walk. This was, oh, I don't know. This was probably 10 to 12 blocks north, to Starbucks, because the nearest Starbucks was actually quite a trek. And, again, we were both, she would have been 19, almost 20, because she's only a year and a half younger than I am. And we, like, it was such a big deal for us to be walking all that way as two lone young ladies that Mr. Gurgany made us each get permission from our fathers. Like, our dads had to call Mr. Gurgany and tell him that they were okay with it.
My word.
And you know what? That day it was raining. We went anyway. We were like, we out.
We're getting out of here.
Peace out.
Peace out.
And it was in the, it was in the fall in Indianapolis. So it was cold too. Like, that's a cold rain right there. But, We didn't care. We got there and we got some hot drinks and sat there for a while. And we didn't have that much time because we had a certain window where we had to check out and then check back in. And then we had to turn around and go back. But
we had to be fast. I remember thinking that it was just crazy that we were allowed to go at all. And it just felt incredible. Like, I felt so special and so lucky, like I was in the in crowd. And you really had to know exactly the right people in order to go.
Yeah, and your specific group had to have like a specific reputation. And I remember mm-hmm. when I don't remember which music group that I was there for. I think maybe it was piano arranging, something like that. And mm-hmm. it was a smaller music class, and we were there for a couple weeks, so we were there over the weekend, and it was piano arranging, and it was mostly girls. I think there were two boys in our class, and the two guys were kind of like, peace out, over the weekend, and they hung out with staff boys and like played basketball in the parking lot and everything. And but the girls were all kind of like, we have nothing to do, oh, maybe we can go to the mall. So our instructor wrote up like a whole proposal to Mr. Gurney to see if we could go to the mall. And there were a couple of malls in Indianapolis that were around the training center. One was further away, but safer. It was like, it was more, I guess it was more like, there wasn't a Victoria's Secret or whatever. I don't know. maybe there wasn't a movie theater there. I don't know. But the other mall that was actually closer and bigger and cooler, was the mall that they didn't often let a lot of people go to. They only let very select groups of people go to that they knew had very good, as Mr. Gergany put it, upstanding character. Like, you had to have a very good reputation, a very specific, like...
Right.
And he said that we... And I think one of the reasons we wanted to go there is because it had a really big food court, and so we could actually kind of make a day out of it. Right. And so we, he said, we don't usually let people go here, but, you know, you should all feel really grateful because you all have the kind of character that we're going to let you go, but you also have to know that you can't. Like, you all have to be in groups of twos or threes. You can't, you know, go off by yourselves and, you know, blah, 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 whatever. So we all went off and, you know, we're trying on clothes and going to Bath and Body Works and, you know, all of these different places and having a good old time. And we're just like, this is a mall. I don't, like, what's so bad about...
I know.
Okay. I don't know. Like, they had more, like, they had more, like, this was back in the day when they had, they didn't have a ton of kiosks yet, but they had a lot of, like, more, like, sidewalk table things set up outside. And I kind of almost wonder if they had a lot of LITs get in trouble there. And if that was kind of the issue, I don't know.
I don't know, though. Like, we just didn't have freedom. Like, we just didn't. You just didn't have the freedom to do stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And so everything was very rat in a maze. Everything was super, super controlled. And we were actually, like, we were just so glad to get out of there. Because... with our particular instructor, she actually kind of towed the line. Like, she was a young woman who is unmarried, who was not living in her father's house, who technically was living under her father's authority, but, you know, according to ATI standards, but wasn't really. And I think it was mostly just so that she could still teach some of the classes and stuff like that during the summer. And she taught college piano during the year and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And so she was really, like, kind of had diverged from a lot of things. And she was very open-minded. And we were just kind of like, she's just kind of like, all right, don't do anything stupid. Like, I don't care. She's only like, I was almost 22 at that point. I think she was like 3 years older than me. It was just.
Yeah.
But yeah, rat in a maze. That's kind of.
Yep. Well, and then, you know, we move into the next section, and it's really interesting to me how she starts reminiscing and thinking back and going over and over just the way life used to be, the arguments she and Moira used to have when they were you know, a couple of single ladies, you know. She talks about how Moira is a lesbian, and, you know, how they would argue over, you know, feminism and the best way to be a good feminist, and, you know, like the things that we all still talk about, you know, just like they were normal good friends and that they could have these good fights. And then but she starts to talk more and more about her job and what it was like to have a job before all of this happened. And I just,
how weird it was, yeah, to think about having a job at that point,
right after all these years now of not having one.
And which I remember thinking about how weird it would be to have a job, like,
yeah,
because I'd never had one before. And just what's it like to leave your house every day and go work and then come home? And
yeah,
that just seems so odd.
Yeah. Well, she goes into a lot of detail about how, and after some of the stuff that's happened in the U.S. with our own issues of watching things regress from where it was, you know, the progress we had made in towards equality, and then watching things start to slip backwards, there's a lot more fight in us than Margaret Atwood imagined. Like, Margaret Atwood didn't, she imagined a world that where everyone kind of just let it all happen. And I thought that that was interesting. You know, she talks about how there were some demonstrations and things like that, but not a whole lot of real fight in everyone. And they talk about passing laws, like, that women couldn't work. Like, how would you miss that? Get a law like that getting passed. Like, that I was hard. This section's hard for me to buy.
I think, well, I think the whole way that basically the coup took place is that the revolution, Gilead, came in, and they executed the president, and they gunned down Congress in session, and they blamed it on Islamic extremists. So they said that they were temporarily suspending the Constitution, and basically they made it look like it was members of the U.S. government still, mm-hmm, and coming in and suspending the Constitution and instating martial law, essentially. Mm-hmm. And she is, I will say, she's leaving out a lot of pieces, but these pieces are pretty standard for something like this, so this is what I'm gonna fill in. So they're suspending the Constitution and instating martial law, and what should have happened immediately if people were going to resist would have been people immediately questioning and saying, wait a minute, were they really Islamic extremists?
Right.
Who actually killed the president? Who actually gunned down Congress? Who's actually running the government right now? Because this was all very quick. However, this is not entirely unheard of for things like this to happen and for people to be so scared,
mm-hmm,
that they just go, oh, somebody's got it. You got it. Okay. We're, mm-hmm, just okay. Because one day everything's business as usual. And the next day, everything's gone. Mm-hmm. And you almost, it's almost a coping mechanism to be in denial and saying, okay, you got it over here. I'm just gonna, yeah. I'll just be over here listening to, you know, doing whatever you say. And then they're not passing laws the way we normally pass laws.
Mm-hmm.
They're setting up a dictatorship.
Yeah.
In a place where there's not been a dictatorship before. And so This, they set the stage perfectly for them to just slide in. And once they have the martial law set up, and once they have things in a place where they know the people are not going to, they've tested the waters a little bit. And now once they know they're not going to have a widespread full-scale rebellion on their hands, then they immediately, in one fell swoop, transfer all women's property to the male next of kin.
Mm-hmm.
And they make it illegal for women to work all at the same time. And this is done in a dictatorial way. And this kind of thing has happened in other countries before. It's like Margaret Atwood has said before, she's not trying to create anything that's new. She's taking things, bits and pieces from places and events and technology that actually exists.
Yep.
It's just that she doesn't spell it all out.
Yeah.
But that's, to me, it's not as much.
Well, and it's interesting because she gets fired. She gets, you know, dumped out with all the other women at her job. She works at a library. And so she goes home. She ends up pacing all around. It's she's not sure what to do with herself. It's really, really well written section. She finally has Moira come over, and Moira and her talk about what's going on. And then Moira leaves, and she goes and picks her daughter up from school. And then she waits for Luke to come home. And she says, by the time Luke got home, I was sitting at the kitchen table. Her daughter was drawing with felt pens in her own little table in the corner. Luke knelt beside me and put his arms around me. I heard, he said, on the car radio driving home. Don't worry, I'm sure it's temporary. Did they say why? I said. He didn't answer that. We'll get through it, he said, hugging me. You don't know what it's like, I said. I feel as if somebody cut off my feet. I wasn't crying. Also, I couldn't put my arms around him. It's only a job, he said, trying to soothe me. I guess you get all my money, I said. And I'm not even dead. I was trying for a joke, but it came out sounding macabre. Hush, he said. He was still kneeling on the floor. You know I'll always take care of you. I thought, already he's starting to patronize me. Then I thought, already you're starting to get paranoid. I know, I said. I love you. So this section just hit me really, really hard.
Oh yeah, me too.
Already, you know, there's this, it's okay, you know, we're married and it's not going to be a big deal. Like, I'll just take care of you. Immediately, the benevolent sexism kicks in and she can't put her finger on what it is.
Like, but he doesn't even get it because, of course,
it's not happening to him.
But here's the thing, too. Like, it makes sense for him to respond the way he's responding. Like,
oh, yeah.
And not even from a sexist point of view. Like, he's not intending to be that way. Like, that's what it ends up being. But he is obviously, like,
he's not really stopping to put himself in her shoes at all. though.
No.
Like, this, although, because it doesn't affect him in the same way.
There's also not really time for that.
Yeah,
so this is,
but he's not losing his rights.
Right. But everybody is going off of their gut reaction because they don't have time to do anything else because this has just happened. And so, of course, his initial instinct, as would be with anybody else in any kind of partnership that was in this kind of position, it would be, oh, well, you'll be fine. I'll take care of you. Like, that's what I would do. Initially, I'd be like, you don't have to, like, I'd be reassuring them. You don't have to worry about it. I will take care of you. You will be fine. But, of course, on the other hand, I very much get, especially as a woman who has spent significant time in an extremely patriarchal society, I feel like my feet, like I've been cut off at my feet. You're now completely reliant on somebody else. You can't take care of yourself. You are now entirely at the mercy of someone else. You have no agency.
Yep.
And that's the big issue. And I know that later on, you know, Luke kind of comes around to see, just because, well, I've read the book before and we've seen the show, like Luke does come around to understand more the significance of what all of this means to June. But in the initial, like, there's just no good way for anybody to respond. There's no good way for it to feel. He's doing the best that he can, honestly, under the circumstances, not being in that situation. And she's just stunned, trying to figure out what the heck is happening.
Yep. She later says, that in this, at the very end of this chapter, she says, that night after I'd lost my job, Luke wanted me to make love. Why didn't I want to? Desperation alone should have driven me, but I still felt numbed. I could hardly feel his hands on me. What's the matter? He said. I don't know, I said. We still have ... he said, but he didn't go on to say what we have, what we still had. It occurred to me that he shouldn't be saying we, since nothing that I knew of had been taken away from him. We still have each other, I said. It was true. Then why did I sound, even to myself, so indifferent? He kissed me then, as if now I'd said that things would get back to normal, but something had shifted, some balance.
Balance of power.
Exactly. I felt shrunken. So that when he put his arms around me, gathered me up, I was as small as a doll. I felt love going forward without me. He doesn't mind this, I thought. He doesn't mind it at all. Maybe he even likes it. We are not each other's anymore. Instead, I am his. That just... it hit me right between the eyes. I felt love going forward without me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing. When the balance of power shifts, love shifts. It isn't the same thing. And, you know, we talk about, you know, consent and stuff like that. And I don't think that that's literally what she's describing here. She's just saying that when you need someone to survive, like literally can't get food without them, love has a different meaning. It shifts. And you and I know what that feels like. And a lot of women do, but but not as many as used to. And I think that that's what she's trying to illustrate here, is that they went backwards. You know? Yeah. Anyhow, it's really, really huge. All right, let's see if we can get through chapter 29.
Yes. So
tell me what jumped out with you with this one.
So she talks about being in the commander's office and how they've both gotten to the place where, again, like with Offglen, they're very casual and comfortable with each other at this point. And that, you know, they're again playing Scrabble. Mm-hmm. And that they finish and he asks her what she would like to read. He says, "What would you like to read tonight? This too has become routine. So far, I've been through a Mademoiselle magazine, an old Esquire from the 80s, a Ms. magazine I can remember vaguely as having been around my mother's various apartments while I was growing up, in a Reader's Digest. He even has novels. I've read a Raymond Chandler, and right now I'm halfway through Hard Times by Charles Dickens. On these occasions, I read quickly, voraciously, almost skimming, trying to get as much into my head as possible before the next long starvation. If it were eating, it would be the gluttony of the famished. If it were sex, it would be a swift furtive stand-up in an alley somewhere. Where I read, the commander sits and watches me doing it without speaking, but also without taking his eyes off me. This watching is a curiously sexual act, and I feel undressed while he does it. I wish he would turn his back, stroll around the room, read something himself. Then perhaps I could read more, take my time. As it is, this illicit reading of mine seems a kind of performance. I think I'd rather just talk, I say. I'm surprised to hear myself saying it. He smiles again. He doesn't appear surprised. Perhaps he's been expecting this or something like it. Oh, he says. What would you like to talk about? I falter. Anything, I guess. Well, you, for instance. Me? He continues to smile. Oh, there's not much to say about me. I'm just an ordinary kind of guy. Yeah. The falsity of this, and even the falsity of diction, guy, pulls me up short. Ordinary guys do not become commanders. You must be good at something, I say. I know I'm prompting him, playing up to him, drawing him out. And I dislike myself for it. It's nauseating, in fact. But we are fencing. Either he talks or I will. I know it. I can feel speech backing up inside of me. It's so long since I've really talked with anyone. The terse, whispered exchange with Offglen on our walk day, or on our walk today, hardly counts. But it was a tease, a preliminary, having felt the relief of even that much speaking. I want more. Mm-hmm. And if I talk to him, I'll say something wrong, give something away. I can feel it coming, a betrayal of myself. I don't want him to know too much. Oh, I was in market research to begin with, he says diffidently. After that, I sort of branched out. It strikes me that although I know he's a commander, I don't know what he's a commander of. What does he control? What is his field, as they used to say? They don't have specific titles. Oh, I say, trying to sound as if I understand. You might say I'm a sort of scientist, he says. Within limits, of course.
can't have too much science happening.
Yeah, right. After that, he doesn't say anything for a while, and neither do I. We're outwaiting each other. I'm the one to break first. Well, maybe you could tell me something I've been wondering about. He shows interest. What might that be? I'm heading into danger, but I can't stop myself. It's mm-hmm. a phrase I remember from somewhere. Best not to say where. I think it's in Latin, and I thought maybe... I know he has a Latin dictionary. He has dictionaries of several kinds. on the top shelf to the left of the fireplace. "Tell me," he says, distanced, but more alert. Or am I imagining it? "Nolite te bestardes cabrandorum," I say. "What?" he says. I haven't pronounced it properly. I don't know how. "I could spell it," I say. "Write it down." He hesitates at this novel idea. Possibly he doesn't remember. I can. I've never held a pencil or a pen or a pencil in this room, not even to add up the scores. "Women can't add," he said once, jokingly.
When I asked what he meant, sexist joke.
I know. When I asked what he meant, he said, "For them, one and one and one and one, what don't make four?" "What do I make? What do they make?" I said, expecting five or three. "Just one and one and one and one," he said. "But now," he says, "all right," and thrusts his roller tip pen across the desk at me defiantly, as if taking a dare. I look around for something to write on. He hands me the score pad, a desktop notepad with a little smile button face printed at the top of the page. They still make those things. I print the phrase carefully, copying it down from the inside of my head, from the inside of my closet. "Nolite te bastardes cabrandorum." Here, in this context, it's neither prayer nor command, but a sad graffiti scrawled once, abandoned. The pen between my fingers is sensuous, alive almost. I can feel its power, the power of the words it contains. "Pen is envy," Aunt Lydia would say, quoting another center motto, warning us away from such objects and warning us away from evil pens.
Oh, how evil.
And they were right. It is envy. Just holding is envy. I envy the commander his pen. It's one more thing I would like to steal. The commander takes a smile button page from me and looks at it. Then he begins to laugh. And is he blushing? "That's not real Latin," he says. "That's just a joke." "A joke?" I say, bewildered now. "It can't be only a joke. Have I risked this, made a grab at knowledge for a mere joke? What sort of joke?" "You know how schoolboys are." He goes on and on about all sorts of different things. And then he says, "It's sort of hard to explain why it's funny unless you know Latin." He said, "We used to write all kinds of things like that. I don't know where we got them from. Older boys, perhaps." "But what did it mean?" I say. "Which?" he says. "Oh, it meant, don't let the bastards grind you down." I guess we thought we were pretty smart back then. I force a smile, but it's all before me now. I can see why she wrote that on the wall of the cupboard. Mm-hmm. But I also see that she must have learned it here. In this room. Where else? She was never a schoolboy. With him, during some previous period of boyhood reminiscence of confidences exchanged, I've not been the first then to enter his silence, play children's word games with him. What happened to her? I say. He hardly misses a beat. Did you know her somehow? Somehow, I say. She hanged herself. He says thoughtfully, not sadly. That's why we had the light fixture removed in your room. He pauses. Serena found out, he says, as if that explains it. And it does. If your dog dies, get another.
Wow.
What with, I say. He doesn't want to give me any ideas. Does it matter, he says. I suppose it was Cora who found her, I say. That's why she screamed. Yes, he said, poor girl. He means Cora. Maybe I shouldn't come here anymore, I say. I thought you were enjoying it, he says, lately watching me, however, with intent, bright eyes. If I didn't know better, I would think it was with fear. I wish you would. You want my life to be bearable to me, I say. Comes out not as a question, but as a flat statement, flat and without dimension. If my life is bearable, maybe what they're doing is all right after all. It's assuaging his own guilt. Mm-hmm. Yes, he says, I do. I would prefer it. Well, then, I say, things have changed. I have something on him now. What I have on him is the possibility of my own death. What mm-hmm. I have on him is his guilt. Mm-hmm. At last. What would you like? He says, still with that lightness, as if it's a money transaction, merely a minor one at that. Candy, cigarettes. Besides hand lotion, you mean, I say. Besides hand lotion, he agrees. I would like to know. It sounds indecisive, stupid even. I say it without thinking. Know what? Whatever there is to know, I say, but that's too flippant. What's going on? Which reminds me of that part in Catching Fire where Katniss and Finnick have their first in-person interaction, and Katniss, of course, still absolutely disdains him, and she says, she's talking about him being, you know, basically the, how do I put this in PG words? the dandy of the Capitol. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And, of course, thinking that that's all, you know, consensual on Finnick's part, which we find out later it's not, but she thinks that he does it all for money, and he says, money, I haven't dealt in anything as common as money for years. And she says, well, what then? And he gets up really close to her and he says, secrets.
Secrets.
Knowledge is power, people.
Knowledge is power is true. Yep. It's a really, really interesting section. We finally know what the Nolite Te Bastardus Carborundorum finally means and where it came from and what it has to do with. Yeah.
I seriously want a tattoo of that.
I know. But if we weren't already such basic white girls. I know,
we can't have matching tattoos.
Now we'll be second basic matching tattoos. White girl feminists on top of it. The most basic white girl feminist thing to do in the whole wide world.
Oh, I'm okay with that. I just don't want, like, we can't have another, like, set of matching tattoos. Like, we can't, like, start having, like sets of matching tattoos. That would just be so bad. Oh, my gosh.
Oh. But I love it. I can't help it.
Hey, at least it's in Latin and not some, like, Chinese character.
It's not like, Latin though, it's fake Latin.
It's Latin.
Oh, it's Latin slang.
Yes, which means that it's not cultural appropriation for us. So
how do you culturally appropriate Latin?
That's what I'm saying. You don't.
I don't think you do that. I don't think that's a thing. So. Watch, somebody will message us and be like, yes, it is, and this is why. And then we'll be educated, and we'll know better.
So I'm just saying, I'm just saying that both of us have enough European ancestors.
Oh, for sure.
Like, I'm as white as they come. I don't have any, like, anything else in me except for, like, the 3% that everybody has that goes back to Africa.
Right.
Like, that's all I have. The rest of me is European. So, not necessarily Romance languages, which derive from Latin, but I feel like that's okay.
Yeah. So, in case you are wondering, Goforth is pretty English. It's about as English.
Yeah,
as
Reynolds is pretty dang Irish. So
yes, now my mom's side of the family is pretty straight Irish, but the Goforth is definitely English. From Yorkshire. Well,
I'm more Hungarian and Irish than anything else, and the rest of me is German and British. So
we could have "Don't Let the Bastards Grind You Down" written in Gaelic on us.
That would be Irish. I love how we said that at the same time.
I know. I love it.
I'm sorry, we're really not making fun of cultural appropriation. We're not.
But we are Irish, so we could just
we like, are Irish, so
we could take phrase and make it Irish.
Oh my gosh!
Oh, this is devolving very fast. This is a hilarious rabbit hole.
But it also it does get kind of difficult with like splitting hairs and what is and what isn't. But I do think it would be okay for us to use, because Latin used to be like the high language of well, it, at first it was a common language of Europe, and then it was the high language of Europe, and and then everybody learned Latin. So I think that would be acceptable as people of European descent to
I'm not gonna worry about
besides,
it.
Besides, like, when is the last time the Europeans were oppressed by anyone?
I don't know. I don't think that's a thing.
I don't think that's a thing. I mean, by other Europeans, yes.
Yes, yeah.
But when was the last time Europeans as a whole?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah, not yeah. really a thing.
No. Yeah, no.
So.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, that wraps up this episode on Handmaid's Tale. We are back at it. We are rolling. So, yeah, next time we'll pick up with chapter 30.
Yep. We will do probably 30 through 32, possibly a little less, possibly a little more, depending.
Yeah, what we get into.
Yep.
But that wraps us up for tonight, and we'll see you next time on Leaving the Village.
Bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up another episode of Leaving the Village.
If you haven't already, hit subscribe so you get our episodes as soon as they drop. Also, check out our social media pages at Leaving the Village Pod on Instagram as well as Facebook.
We will post behind-the-scenes photos, links to more information, and sneak peeks at upcoming guests. Message us with your stories and you might be featured on a future episode. Also, if you love the show, rate and comment on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps a lot.
Speaking of helping us, you can actually sponsor our show on Patreon, which also gets you access to exciting exclusive content. Our show is written and produced by me, Jessica Goforth, and Kathleen Reynolds. Special thanks to our families who are so supportive of this show, and to you, our fans. Thank you so much, and see you next time on Leaving the Village.
Then I think she endures verbal abuse for a season, and she endures perhaps being smacked one night, and then she seeks help from the church.
There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus, and by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options.
There's nothing holy about writing discrimination into the law, and I am tired of communities of faith being weaponized, because the only time religious freedom is invoked is in the name of bigotry and discrimination. I'm tired of it.
Hi, I'm Nate, producer and co-host on the Full Mutuality podcast. Let's talk about inequality. It's everywhere. Whether it's rooted in race, gender, ability, or sexuality, there's bound to be an imbalance in power, influence, representation, and access. On our show, we want to explore areas of religion, culture, and society where justice is needed in order to bring about true mutuality. I hope you'll join us for some enlightening, fun, and at times uncomfortable conversations as we envision a world where everyone can live free from systems and structures that keep us from being truly equal. You can find us on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, fullmutuality.com, to find a list of all the platforms we're available on. Subscribe today, and we'll see you on the Full Mutuality Podcast.